This is Critical Edge, where we learn how to think, not what to think. Welcome back, everyone. We're here with Dominic Sandbrook, co-host of the very successful podcast and one of our fierce competitors. The rest is history. Dominic, in maybe 20 words or less, could you just introduce yourself to our audience?
Hi, everybody. I'm Dominic Sandbrook. I'm the host of The Rest is History. It's an enormous joy for me to be working on a properly professional, well-run podcast with accomplished and articulate presenters rather than the amateurs that I usually work with. So it's a real joy. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Good stuff, Dominic. Thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited for this one. And one question I think we would like to start today with, and something we usually ask, is when was the last time you changed your mind in a really significant way?
That's a good question. When did I change my mind in a significant way?
Yeah.
I'll tell you the thing that I probably changed my mind about in my work is J.K. Rowling.
Really?
I wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Great British Dream Factory, which was all about British popular culture and its impact on the world and where it comes from and its kind of historical roots. And I did a chapter on that about school stories, so boarding school stories and their importance in the British imagination. So obviously Harry Potter is a school story, and it's modelled in part on Tom Brown's School Days, the great Victorian school story, one of the most influential stories of the Victorian era because it was so important in educational reform and so on. And in the course of writing this, I was very disobliging about Harry Potter. And I said I thought it was rubbish, basically. Right. But then, I mean, literally like 18 months later, my son massively got into Harry Potter. And he got into it first as an audiobook. We were driving around America and he just would get out of the car. You know, he was completely addicted to it. And then he started reading the books and then he saw the films and he just sort of became absorbed by the world. You know, completely entranced by it, as so many people are. And I realized that basically I've been guilty of a massive failure of imagination. So I had not treated it with the same sort of imaginative sympathy that I had treated other things that I'd enjoyed when I was young. And I'd sort of I'd given into sneering at it and the easy path of negativity rather than taking on its own terms and imagining what it was like as a child to have read it. So I guess when I said J.K. Rowling, loads of your listeners were like, oh, brilliant, he's going to get into the trans issue.
That's what I expected.
But no, I can care less about the trans issue. I was wrong about it. I didn't take it seriously enough. And actually now I think it's an amazing achievement because I've seen firsthand the impact that it has on younger readers. So that's a really good example. That's probably the one thing that I've written that I would change if I had a chance. So there you go. Bet you weren't expecting that.
No, it's a couple U-turns there. Just but historians often look to that sort of thing, basically what makes up the cultural web of references in a society in order to understand something about them. You've ruled out Harry Potter. What did you think you might have missed about the history of a younger generation by not understanding what was in those books?
I don't think it's that I miss necessarily what a particular generational experience, because I suspect that if I had read them when I was growing up in the 80s, I would have loved them just as much. So I don't think it's a particularly generational thing, but I think it's the power of, I mean, you're dead right. You know, things that you read, you know, things that seem to be quite trivial and quite frivolous are often much more important historically than things that you think are terribly worthy and artistic, not least because more people consume them and because they are much more influential in the way that the kind of collective imagination works. So I think probably what I missed was, you know, as a reader, not so much as a historian, but as a reader of fiction, obviously, and as somebody appraising anything, you have to make a kind of imaginative leap. Actually, you do that as a historian. You have to do that all the time. I don't know why I said you didn't have to do it as a historian. You always have to kind of put yourself in somebody else's shoes and imagine what it's like for them reading or consuming something. And I guess the temptation when you're writing about culture is always to sort of slightly put yourself on your pedestal and sort of look down your nose at it. And I guess that was probably the mistake that I was making.
I think there's so much to learn about, for example, a particular culture and why something becomes so popular. For example, mm-hmm. what do you think about Harry Potter? What does it tell us about the zeitgeist at the time and why it became so popular?
Huh, good question. So I think, I mean, the obvious thing to say about it is that it's a boarding school story at a time when, which is really interesting, that it, in a time when the culture was becoming more overtly egalitarian, the boarding school stories were still so deeply rooted that loads of people, you know, who'd never go to a boarding school read it. And I think part of that is because they're so deeply rooted in Britain's popular culture anyway. So many characters, you know, James Bond is a boarding school product, for example. So many characters are from boarding schools that you end up taking for granted almost. So I think that's part of it. I think actually it's weird for me to see in the last sort of 10 years or so, people have started to sort of the more well-known issue aside, people have started to turn on J.K. Rowling a bit and say, oh, well, you know, her characters are racial stereotypes or ethnic stereotypes or whatever. When in fact, if you judge it by the standards of the time in which it was written, her book is really progressive. You know, her book is a massive break with the books that I would have read growing up. So the multiculturalism of Harry Potter, I think, is very 1990s. And that might seem risible to people in the 2010s or 2020s. But I think at the time, it was definitely perceived as quite, I guess, groundbreaking to some extent. So I think it was probably perceived as quite progressive by the standards of the society at the time. But I guess the thing that is more interesting to me is not so much, oh, how does it reflect the specific circumstances of its creation, but more, how does it reflect the kind of underlying continuity in the kind of stories that people love? So the basic device of Harry Potter, which is something that I think Sigmund Freud called it the family romance, if I remember rightly, which is this idea that basically children dream of that they're special, that they're, maybe their parents aren't their true parents. They fantasize about being an orphan or, you know, going away from home, leaving the restraining influence of their parents behind, that perhaps they've got a special destiny, you know, something that sets them out from their peers. They have a series of challenges that they have to overcome. And through that, they learn more about themselves. They make friends along the way and they end up overcoming evil and basically getting the recognition that they've always craved. Yeah, that's the story of, King Arthur drawing the sword from the stone. It's Luke Skywalker getting his lightsaber and meeting Obi-Wan Kenobi. It's so many such stories. And the fact that Harry Potter can be mapped so easily onto that, I think is a sign of just how deep-seated some of these kind of archetypes are. I have to say, I never thought when we did this that we'd be talking so much about, for the first 8 minutes or whatever, about Harry Potter.
Neither, did we.
There you go. That's the joy of a podcast, right?
Yeah. Okay, so people say the recent history is always the most difficult to understand. The present time is the time we understand the least. But being a professional historian, you might do a better job than most. How do you think people in the future will look back at this historical period, let's say the last 20 years or so, based on your understanding of what's culturally important now, how people are viewing the things that are happening, not just what's happening?
In Britain or worldwide?
Let's say globally. Naturally, I think we're always going to be talking slightly more about the West, right? But let's zoom it out as much as possible.
So, I mean, historians never see in a given period what you think they'll see in it, because the things that interest you are not what interest them. So if I was thinking, you know, if Victorians saw what we make of the Victorian period, they would just be completely confused. And they would say, you're insane. How can you possibly find this interesting, when the really interesting thing was the argument about, you know, the Third Reform Act or something?
Can you give specific examples of what we look at that they would find ridiculous?
Yeah,
particularly?
So if you look at the books that are written on Victorian Britain, they're kind of dominated by, well, like books on any period, they're dominated by the concerns of our day. So, you know, race, gender, identity, all of those kinds of things. Understandably, that's what historians want to look at, because those are the questions that they think are interesting. So we kind of impose that intellectual framework on the past. And that is, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, by the way. I mean, historians always do that. But obviously, if you said to, you know, Matthew Arnold or William Gladstone, have a look at this, have a read of this, what do you make of this? That's what people are saying, you know, the great experts are saying about your period now. They'd be like, they'd be completely baffled by it. And they would say, this is absolutely demented. These aren't the interesting things about our time at all. So when people in the 24th century are writing the history of our time, the things that interest them will probably be things that we don't even, that we take for granted or we don't find interesting at all or remarkable. And it's almost hard for us to imagine what they could possibly be. Obviously, the big themes of our life at the moment are things like, you know, climate change, I guess, technological change. I mean, you know, if this is a sort of second industrial revolution that we're living through or even greater, then that will be the story that people are fascinated by, right? And they won't be interested in politicians and, you know, what they see as cultural ephemera at all. I guess the bigger challenge for historians writing about our current moment is simply the proliferation and fragmentation of culture and of stuff. So for me, even for me writing about the 1960s and 1970s, you know, there's a fairly sort of set canon or corpus of stuff that you look at, fiction, film, music, whatever. It'll be so difficult for somebody writing about the 2020s because there's just so much of it. You know, what do you look at? What do you focus on? So the contrast with writing about much earlier periods is enormous. And that, I think, will make it very hard for them to, you know, I don't envy them trying to come up with a kind of unified narrative, and particularly of world history, right? I mean, that's almost impossible. But I'm guessing some of the things, you know, the continuing rise of China, for example, the rise of India, they'll be really important to people. Obviously, AI, maybe things like the decline of the West, the challenge of an aging population, migration, for example. I mean, those are the things that right now you'd anticipate future historians would talk about. But as so often, you know, you don't know how the story ends. So because you don't know how the story plays out, you don't know how interesting it will turn out to be. You know, maybe there will be the sort of Donald Trump fantasy of a reassertion of national borders, and you know, the age of migration that we've been living through turns out to be an anomaly. Maybe it doesn't, and it becomes the norm, and migration becomes even more pronounced than it is now. You know, so how people write about the 2020s will depend, I guess, very much on what happens in the 2030s and 2040s.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you picked up on Donald Trump. Something Ollie and I were discussing before in terms of history is how often people and politicians would look back to something quote unquote greater when maybe right now doesn't seem so good. How do you understand that as part of this human need to look back, even though its quote unquote goodness might be really up for debate?
Oh, it's completely standard. I mean, there's nothing unusual at all. So make America great again. Trump isn't even the first person to have said it. I think Reagan said it. But I mean, there's no point in, people sometimes sort of say, well, gosh, this is, what does this say about Reagan that he said this? But I mean, effectively all politicians say this. It's a standard opposition politician trope. That basically you say to people, look, the current people are useless. Don't you feel that things used to be better, you know, before the anxieties of the current moment? I'm going to make our country respected and prosperous again. And you know, all the current woes will magically disappear. So, yeah, Trump says it very kind of starkly and has turned it into his mantra and indeed his movement. But the sentiment is as old as politics itself, that something has been lost and we want to restore it. I mean, if you go to, let's say, I mean, choose a wildly different historical example, 17th century England, the Civil Wars. You know, when the parliamentarians were fighting, or radicals were fighting Charles I, they didn't say, we're trying to create something new, so much as they said, we're trying to restore something that's been lost, our ancient liberties and, you know, all of this kind of thing. Sometimes they were going right back into history and saying this has been lost because of the Norman yoke. These are the traditional liberties of the Anglo-Saxon people. That idea of a lost golden age, the kind of the political power of nostalgia, that's always been part of a successful politician's toolkit. So, yeah, I mean, Reagan harked back to the 1950s. Clinton, when he won the presidency in the 1990s, you know, said, oh, things used to be better. You know, the 60s were better than they are today. I mean, it's a very, very common political device. And I fully expect we'll see it used again in the future.
I think something people don't realize about nationalism in that way is that it's not just, I think, individual politicians, but it's also quite important to the politics of a nation as a whole to have something like a founding national myth. So I'm half French, and when I was listening to your series, or your multiple series, I think there's now two or three maybe, on the French Revolution, a lot of it was quite enlightening for me because, you know, I wasn't particularly interested in French history having grown up in England until I got to it, really. And, you know, Bastille Day, the date is drilled into your head from a young age and so on and so forth. And you don't realize actually that following the original events of the French Revolution, then there was the Terror, then Napoleon came around, July Monarchy and so on and so forth. I'm painting with broad brushstrokes, but it's a really complicated story. How do we form something like a healthy nationalism based on something like a positive view of the nation without confounding historical fact and oversimplifying things?
Oh, you don't. That's a mad enterprise. I mean, that's the sort of thing that, do you know, when I was a PhD student or when I was an academic, you'd sit there in seminars and people with furrowed brows would say, gosh, it's so terrible that the public believe all these myths, isn't it? What a shame. How can we educate them out of it? And I just, even then I used to think, you know, you're demented. Like, the public want to believe this stuff. They don't want to sit around in a history seminar and be lectured by some pedant about what actually happened in 1940. So the idea that, I mean, any nation's story, I mean, a nation is nothing if not a story. A narrative is central to a country's sense of itself. A shared national narrative is absolutely at the core of what it is to be patriotic, or, you know, you use the word nationalism, let's say patriotism. Inevitably, that will end up sort of being centered around a series of comforting myths, if you like. So in France, it's the revolution. In Britain, it's probably the summer of 1940, Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, and so on. In the United States, it's the American Revolution, or Abraham Lincoln or something. You know, all countries have them. And I don't think they are unhealthy. I think they're completely healthy. In the same way that you as an individual have myths about yourself, or your family has stories that you tell that are simplified, comforting family anecdotes or whatever, or a sense of yourselves, or a couple will have a kind of founding myth of how they got together and blah, 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 in which all the sort of complications and the rows have been magically smoothed out, right? I mean, that's just completely normal. That is healthy. That's how human beings function. So I don't personally have a problem with the fact that, for example, you know, I think it's completely natural and healthy that people in Britain think, you know, they stood alone in 1940, that Dunkirk happened in the back. I mean, I think as national myths go, that's not a very pernicious one. You know, the French Revolution, there's a lot of bloodshed, a lot of people died in the Terror, all the rest of it. When I look at Bastille Day, you know, am I seething and thinking I'd love to go over there and give them a good talking to? No, of course not, because, I mean, I think that's completely natural and normal that people have these founding myths. I think where a myth can become pernicious is when it curdles into a sense of victimhood, or where it relies on the demonization of somebody else. I mean, a lot of nationalisms have that at their core. You know, you look at the Balkans, for example. A lot of relatively new states, and at the center of their sense of themselves is often a sense that they basically had to fight for their independence against the people next door, who were uniquely terrible and would probably like to kill them again if they had the chance. And that obviously can be very unhealthy. But by and large, the example you give, for example, of the French Revolution and as a founding myth, or Joan of Arc might be another one, you know, I don't think those are unhealthy at all. And I think moaning and groaning that they don't match what scholarly historians think happened in the past is a sort of misunderstanding of what the point of them is.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting way of thinking about it. I am Maltese and grew up in Malta. So, you know, the 1565 Great Siege in Malta is something that's drilled into you as a child, and that's something in the national conscience, even though, and it's taught to us as a historic point, not only for Malta, but for Europe as a whole. So it's quite interesting in that sense, you know, regardless of how true it maybe is, however you want to understand the word true. The question I had is very related to that. It's related to education and how something is taught. This is something that Reform UK have been talking about as well a lot. Is how do we teach, for example, British history to students, and both the good things but also the bad things that, for example, the British Empire did. What's your opinion on that? You know, the British Empire and colonialism is to some extent part of the national myth in Britain. There is, of course, so much about it that is negative.
Mm-hmm.
How do you break that down, and how should it be taught? Should we teach young kids the negative aspects of British history in such a strong sense?
Well, first of all, I don't really divide history into positive and negative. I think that's very sort of a slight, dare I say, I'm not saying it of you, of course, but I think it's a slightly simplistic way of looking at it. So I think the sort of what people call the balance sheet, I wouldn't necessarily do that. I think, would I teach the British Empire? I mean, I think teachers can teach what they like, actually. I mean, there's an awful lot of British history, and I don't think governments should be prescriptive about it, not least because often in a lot of schools, the one thing that nobody ever talks about, really, with regard to schools and the teaching of history, is that in a lot of schools, children only do 2 45-minute or 40-minute hours, you know, periods of history a week. So there's very little you can get through. And to say, well, I think they should do the whole sweep of British history is crazy. There's no way you can possibly get through all of that and do it justice in that amount of time. So you have to pick and choose. Clearly, the British Empire is a fascinating subject, really important subject. I think doing it with a moralizing or finger wagging one way or the other is frankly boring for children as much as it probably is quite boring for the teachers. I actually never think this is as complicated as other people seem to think.
Right.
I just think you just say what happened, tell the whole story. I mean, kids love the violence, you know, why not put that in? Everybody loves people being fired out of cannons. That's brilliant. Put it in.
I guess what I meant, and just to clarify, it's not always possible to tell the whole story, right? So where do you, that's the job of a historian. As you, of course, know, you need to leave some bits out. So I think part of what, for example, Reform UK might say is we're teaching too much the negative aspects of British history. We should be more proud rather than criticize the fact that, you know, Britain colonized so many countries and took the slaves and so on.
It's a good question. And it's a fair question because, of course, you're right that what you choose, you have to make choices. Personally, I think clearly you have to have a fair bit of balance, and it would be irresponsible not to. And I think you can, for example, tell a story of the British Empire and say, you know, this happened and this was, you know, very kindly. This happened and it involved, you know, shooting loads of people. You know, you can sort of, you want to give what you honestly think is a fair portrait, I guess. I mean, I'm thinking about like when I've done children's books, which I do a history series for children. You know, you don't want to just tell them something that's madly partisan and biased, because I think then you're cheating them in some way if you don't allow them to glimpse the sort of the capaciousness of the past. I think if your national teaching of history does not at some basic level inculcate some sense of belonging.
Pride.
Yeah, a degree of pride. I mean, I was hesitant to say pride because I didn't want to sound like I was the Reform UK education spokesman. However, I think it is weird if you have a national education system that doesn't make people feel, you know, I mean, basically, ideally, to be a healthy country, you want people to be quite proud to belong to that country. And so, for example, you know, my wife is Irish. The Irish education system, I think it does make people feel proud to be Irish, and quite right too. The American education system makes people very proud to be American. I don't think that's unhealthy. I think that's normal and natural. It's like, to give the analogy, if a nation is an extended family, it's pretty weird to bring someone up in your family and to not make them feel pleased to be part of it and to feel a sense of belonging and a sense of commitment to it. And so I think if you're part of a nation, you know, you want to feel quite proud to belong to that nation. So I don't think it's unhealthy or unnatural for a British education system to hope that at the end of the story, you know, at the end of the process, people will come out and they'll be pleased to be British and they'll see the good in it. I think that is perfectly compatible with saying, you know, the slave trade was horrible and we, you know, were prime movers in it, for example. I mean, I don't think those, because I think children are much more, I think there's sometimes a slightly condescending attitude towards the intelligence of children that's taken by campaigners on this issue. They can only cope with one thing in their head at a time. Mm. Whereas actually, having done loads of school talks and having written for children, I mean, children are obviously far more intelligent generally than adults because they haven't made up their minds about things. And they're perfectly capable of having multiple things going on in their head at once. You know, to say of somebody, well, Winston Churchill was a great fellow in all the kinds of ways, but he had feet of clay and he wasn't perfect. I mean, a 10-year-old can completely get their head around that. They have no problem with that. So the idea that it's all pride or all shame, I think, is bonkers.
Just to stretch your analogy, though, about the family as a model for the nation, right? And you say it would be weird to grow up in a family and they say, well, this family's horrible. I don't want to stretch the metaphor too far, but if you grow up in an abusive family, right, it might actually be problematic to be told that you're growing up in a great family from the beginning. And so despite you not being, generally, I think you have quite an anti-moralist approach to history, right? Like you don't want us to draw lessons too strongly. And yet my fear with the aim of cultivating national pride is that it can end up leading to you doing that sort of thing implicitly, can't it?
What, that you are in an abusive relationship with your country and you need to...
Or you can be. I don't want to talk for every country or for every family, right? But as an aim, I think it's going to lead to a partisan reading of history, right? Because you're going into it with the aim to come out with a certain viewpoint about something.
Yeah, but what's the alternative? The alternative is that you're suggesting that there is a perfectly neutral way of interpreting history that is from an inverted commas objective standpoint that stands outside any hint of taint or bias or whatever. And I don't believe there can ever be such a thing.
Shouldn't the emphasis then be on, let's say, for example, bringing an issue like, let's just stick on the empire because I think that makes it easy, right? Bringing the British Empire, for example, and being like, okay, what are we going to think about this by the end of the lesson? Or what are we going to think about this by the end of the 2 weeks? And encourage children to construct the narratives themselves.
Yeah, completely. I think you would. I think ideally, if I was a teacher, I would want them to believe that they'd come to their own opinion and then form their own opinion, but actually that opinion was my opinion. That's the thing. That's what I would aim for. No, I think clearly you need to listen. I think a fair-minded way of approaching this is to say you want children to think for themselves. They can come to a variety of different opinions and they will reflect their own personal approach to a subject. When I was talking about pride and shame, I wasn't saying, you know, that should be written into the, you know, it should be a bullet point. We want people to feel proud of our country. I think what I was more saying was, I think it is reasonable if there is if you're putting your finger on the scales a tiny bit, because ideally you do want to emphasize, I think a normal country teaches things that it's quite proud of. Now, that's not to say they don't emphasize, they don't do other things as well. They don't say there were also black moments when this and this happened. But I think it would be weird to have people doing history between, let's say, the ages of 8 or 9 and 16 and to say, well, for these 7.5 years or whatever, let's concentrate on everything Britain got wrong. I mean, I think that would be a really weird, I mean, that really would be an abusive family, I would say. I think most countries teach predominantly their own history, and they do so approaching it from a standpoint of they quite like their history by definition. And I'm just thinking if you're, I'm not going to choose a really, a country that you wouldn't think has a, you know, that's not, you're not going to accuse, you're going to tell me is an abusive family. So let's say Slovenia or Switzerland or Norway. Those countries do not have, you know, very terribly checkered histories. I think it's completely understandable that if you're at school in Ljubljana or in Oslo, you come out of your history lessons thinking, I'm actually quite proud to be Norwegian or Slovenian or whatever. I mean, I think most people listening to this would think that was a reasonable position to take. I don't think that's incompatible with exploring the complexity of the past and having some room to make up your own mind. And indeed, there may be some people who come out of those lessons who say, I'm actually, you know, I actually think worse of my country than I did at the beginning. And I think that's kind of fine. But I think if 90% of the class come out saying, God, I hate my country, I wish I wasn't Slovenian, then the Slovenian education ministry would have a long, hard look at themselves.
Well, it's probably not great for the cohesion of the society overall. It's obviously a balance.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I just want to talk about fascism for a second. That's quite a topic jump.
Okay. We've done them all. We've done J.K. Rowling, we've done schools, and now we're on to British Empire, now we're on to fascism. Brilliant.
Exactly. Well, it's a term that's being used more and more to describe the political climate in the present day. Before we talk about the salience of that comparison itself, how salient are comparisons like that in general from another historical period to the present? Does it make sense to take a category like fascism and bring it to the present?
I think if you're careful with it, I think you can see obviously parallels and similarities between different movements and different time periods. And I think that's, if you didn't do that and you study history, that'd be kind of weird. However, to very simplistically say that one, this thing equals that thing. In other words, Donald Trump is Hitler, or a few years ago, Boris Johnson is Hitler or whatever. I think that is not helpful. I think, because I think often what it acts to do is to close down the conversation rather than open it up again. So in other words, let's say Donald Trump is Hitler, that conversation. You know, once you've said that, there's nowhere to go with it, because you're basically saying he's incredibly evil, and you know this is going to end in the deaths of millions of people, and what a terrible person. And there's really nothing more to say from that point. I would argue. I think, you know, so in other words, I would say these analogies you handle with care, and you use them in such a way that they allow the possibility of further conversation rather than shutting it down, I guess. I mean, on the fascism point, personally, I don't like to use that word, I think for two reasons. One, I think fascism is a period-specific thing. So although there are definite continuities and similarities between the politics of the early 20th century and our own politics, and indeed, you know, there are sort of patterns of political dissent. So there are parties that trace back their history, the Front National, for example, or in Italian parties that trace their history back to, you know, the 1930s or 1940s. I think it's not very helpful to say, well, this is just exactly the same kind of thing, because the context of the 20s and 30s was so different. Paramilitary politics, fragmentation after the First World War, the cult of the leader, imperialism, you know, and also the sort of the fascist dream of like making a new man, making a new society. The corporatism of fascism, I get another dissimilarity. So there are lots of differences that I think make it useless to say that this is just fascism now. However, you know, there are also some interesting resonances and kind of rhymes, if you like. So I think it's a label that it's a tricky label, I guess. And I think the other thing about it is because it's so morally charged, it's a bit like calling somebody a racist, right? As soon as you say it, bang, that's it. End of conversation. They're just a terrible person. And so because it's so morally charged and because therefore it makes further debate very difficult, I don't always think it's a terribly useful thing to say.
Yeah, I think that's almost the point. When someone calls you a fascist, it's similar to calling you a racist. And I think the people who call Trump a fascist don't necessarily regret the fact that they're putting a strong label on it.
Yeah, of course they don't. Yeah.
Right, because for them, because that's the way they view it. So the rightly describing Trump in that way. Maybe populist is would you agree is maybe a more general term?
Oh, he's definitely a populist. Yeah, he's definitely a populist. He has authoritarian tendencies. Clearly, in many ways, he kind of fancies himself as a bit of a strong man, you know, kind of authoritarian strong man. I don't think he has a terribly deep-seated attachment to democracy or the rule of law. But is he a fa- I mean, is Mussolini the obvious comparison, or Hitler? I mean, are there not lots of other comparisons that are just as good? I think there are. And I think when you reach for those, the most loaded and sort of incendiary and toxic comparisons possible, it's almost a way to kind of stop thinking about it, because it, you know, you just say, well, he's evil, end of story. He's the most evil. He's basically a reincarnation of the most evil man has ever lived. And I don't think that's very helpful or very, I actually don't think it's very interesting. But definitely populism. Yeah, he's a classic populist. Populists have often, like Trump, come from well-heeled backgrounds. They often, you know, are rich, showman, flamboyant, and, you know, they have a genius, as he does, for mobilizing the sort of the masses against a supposedly out of touch metropolitan elite. I mean, he basically is the quintessential classic populist, and he's very good at it.
I think there is a feeling that people, you know, politics and history seem to be, well, are obviously so closely tied together that using a word like fascism to hark back to that time in the early 20th century does just hold so much argumentative and political power that it's a useful political tool as well to call Trump a fascist. Not that necessarily it's accurate or not accurate, but I think that's almost besides the point how accurate it truly is, because it takes on a new meaning. It has taken on a new meaning, fascism in itself. So I'd maybe also disagree that when we now in 2025 say fascism, it necessarily needs to link back to the Italian fascism, for example.
Fair enough. But then what you're saying is, and I agree with you, people do use it and they don't think in terms of, they're not thinking about Italian fascism. And a good example of this is I did a thing on election night in America on YouTube with the Rest is Politics, our sister podcast. And I ended up being in an argument with Anthony Scaramucci, Trump's former director of communications, about whether or not...
He's joining us later this month.
No way. He's a great man. Say hi to him from me. About whether or not Trump is a fascist. And Anthony was like, he's a fascist. He's a fucking fascist. All of this kind of thing, right? And what he meant by that was he's a bad man and he's not a Democrat and he's an authoritarian and he's I hate him. That's really what he meant by fascism. And if I'd sort of said to him, well, I'm going to dig out my copies of, you know, my textbooks on 1930s Italy. I mean, he's not really interested in that, because he's using it, as you were describing, in a more moralistic, really as a sort of moralistic description as much as anything. He's a bad guy and, you know, he's a bully and all of those kinds of things, which, you know, I think he is a bully and I do think he's quite a bad guy. But I just don't think fascist is the label that I would choose to describe him. I mean, I just don't think he fits the bill. Anyway, I mean, you know, lots of your listeners will undoubtedly agree with Anthony and not with me.
The big lesson I think you generally take from history is that human nature isn't quite as rosy as we now think it might be. That we all have, to speak in Jungian terms, we all have this shadow, this dark part of ourselves that we don't recognize in ourselves. Do you think we're avoiding, you know, to some extent, we don't see that to the same extent today? Do you think that is what explains the rise of authoritarianism in the 21st century to some degree, is a lack of historical awareness of that shadow, of that capacity for things to go wrong?
That's a good question. I think there's a couple of things there. So one is that, As the Second World War has faded into history, so people the lessons of it, as it were, just don't have the power that they once did. I think that's undoubtedly true, that basically in the 1980s, let's say, or the 1970s, you know, it's within living memory, it's a massive scar on the European imagination. And so, you know, there are things that are unsayable. And now they are definitely sayable. And that's partly also due to technological change that social media and things has made them sayable in a way. So I think that's part of it. I think there's possibly a... There is an argument that we've become quite frivolous as a society because we don't, we're actually so spoiled and so comfortable that we don't realize how things, you know, how bad things can be. But actually, because everything works really well, by and large, I mean, I know that's, that might sound to lots of listeners as completely mad, but because things actually do work well by historical standards, we feel we can indulge ourselves and elect people who are totally useless because we can kind of get away with it and we can, you know, we've been spoiled, in other words. But to your deeper point, I do think probably we are not cognizant of how fortunate we are compared with most people who've ever lived. You know, reading about, you know, as I do for the, my podcast or when I'm reviewing books or whatever, the huge sweep of human history, you know, I'm always struck by how terrible things were for most people for so much of the time. You know, they didn't have the comforts that we take for granted. They didn't live anything like as long. They, their lives were much more unhealthy, but also they were much more liable to unexpected violence, to misfortune. You know, there are parts of kind of Europe where there's a reasonable chance that at some stage during your life, an invading army will come into your village and kind of, you know, rape and pillage and destroy everything. You know, and there are long periods in human history where that has been the case. Now, most people, you know, who live in Tunbridge Wells do not anticipate that happening anytime soon. And, you know, they'd be very unfortunate if it did. So I think probably we are, it's because we're in a very fortunate position of being oblivious, perhaps, to the depths of which we are capable. But having, you know, maybe I read too many history books. What always strikes me is how, you know, even people who appear to be otherwise completely normal and kind of decent are capable of terrible things. And I think you can't, to me, I'm always bewildered when historians are quite moralistic and they expect people in the past to have behaved better. Because I kind of think, surely you've read enough by now to know that nobody ever does, or at least very few people do. And that actually, you know, the one of the remarkable things about human beings is their extraordinary capacity for kind of cruelty and sadism and greed and duplicity and all these kinds of things. I mean, I know that's a terribly bleak message for your listeners. I'm very sorry. But that's the nature of human life and of history.
Very Hobbesian.
Yeah, very Hobbesian. Well, I am very Hobbesian in that sense. I mean, I totally am very Hobbesian. And actually, yeah, it goes back to your authoritarian point. You know, is the rise of authoritarianism, partly because people have forgotten the legacy of the past? Maybe to some degree, but also authoritarians have an enduring appeal. People like, you know, the sort of the firm smack of government. They like feeling the steady hand. They, you know, the success of somebody like Vladimir Putin in Russia, much as I abhor him, is understandable, right? I mean, most leaders in history have looked like him, they look much more like him than they look like Keir Starmer. Mm-hmm. So if you have that Hobbesian view, I mean, I'm basically now just going to compliment myself on my own worldview. So I'm just warning everybody to prepare for that. Basically, I think if you have that worldview, then so much of history and politics makes much more sense than if you are permanently disappointed and indignant that life isn't measuring up to your lofty expectations.
Hmm. I think always growing up, I was, without realizing, what you would call a Whiggish historian. So for our listeners, the basic idea, and I'm going to oversimplify to some extent, is that history is a process of progress where technologically, morally, and so on and so forth, humanity is basically getting better with blips here and there. I don't think I was unique in that respect. I think most people of my generation grew up with that sort of belief that things just are getting better. And the Hobbesian view effectively is kind of the antithesis of that, that history is about power, about people beating each other, asserting dominance, and so on and so forth. Now, I think I found the Whiggish view of history naive more recently than I'd like to admit, but I'm still not entirely convinced that there isn't some form of moral progress that can occur throughout history. So how can we, you know, like with the development of international institutions, human rights across the world, obviously these things aren't respected 100% of the time, that they were never going to be? How can we find a midpoint between those two? Because I think they do really influence the way that we look at the future also.
Can't both those things be true at once, though? So in other words, you could say that, this would be quite a kind of conservative, almost Burkean argument, that basically we have built an infrastructure over the generations that works really well to tame our worst instincts and to, you know, get us to behave ourselves, as it were. I mean, that would probably be my argument. So I do think institutions are really important, personally, and I do think they work. And I think a world without them would be a kind of slightly terrifying kind of cutthroat world. But that doesn't mean that I don't think human nature has changed. I mean, clearly the context has changed and the expectations of human behavior have in the West anyway, I mean, in much of the world, in fact, have changed. So I think you can actually, can you not hold both those ideas in your head at once? You can think that, for example, Steven Pinker in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, argues that, you know, violence has declined, that we're becoming much less violent. And he's got tons of data and it's very controversial. I mean, I think you could say it's clearly true that every day, you know, it's very unlikely that I'm going to be murdered by a highwayman. Or that brigands will attack my house. I mean, it's possible, but it's very unlikely. But if something does go wrong, then the capabilities of, you know, that you have to inflict harm through industrialized society is so much greater now. So you can kill millions of people really quickly in a way that you couldn't before. So you can still live in a very dark, you can live in a world that's getting lighter, but maybe the blips become darker, I guess. I think you said, you know, we're becoming about moral progress. I'm not entirely sure about that, actually, because I often think the world, if you showed our world to, let's say, my great grandparents, would they think it was morally better than their own? I'm not sure that they would, because I think there are lots of things that they would look at. I mean, they would look at some things, right, that we don't even think of, and they would say, it's just mind-boggling that you allow that to happen, that you allow, that people can watch extreme pornography on their computers. They would be like, how is that? What kind of world are you living in where that is possible? Because that would seem to them an utter moral outrage. And there are lots of small things like that that we perhaps don't, because we live in a different moral universe, that we have regressed, but they might say that we have. So I dislike the idea of moral progress, because I think you need an external yardstick or an external authority against which to judge. And I don't think such a thing, because I'm not a religious person, I don't think such a thing exists. So in that sense, I'm a complete relativist, I'm afraid.
Okay. I'm struggling to think of a way to construct the external yardstick, right? That's basically where the pause is coming from. That what I was going to follow up with was, you know, again, I'm going to be pulling from basically our cultural moral bank in order even to say this, right? But I think as a general, for example, the focus on human rights, right? The probably overall decrease in suffering, like Steven Pinker said, the decrease in violence. These are things that can be tracked against history. Can be tracked through history. And they're simple moral points, right? The moral texture there isn't that complicated. It's about the accumulation of historical fact. Do you think it's still problematic for a historian to look at something like that and go, look, this has gotten better in this regard? My worry is that, you know, if we don't make any sort of judgment on the past, we're doing something more like chronicling than history, because that judgment is part of the narrative and part of constructing a view of whichever historical period it is.
Okay, so on the narrative front, I think you're inevitably gonna, I think there's no such thing as a judgment-free narrative, or as you rightly say, it would be very boring. It would just be a mere succession of facts. But even the choice of facts implies a kind of judgment, right? So I think a judgment-free narrative is fine. And I think to write any kind of interesting history book, a degree of judgment always comes into it. I think the problem I would have in moralistic judgment is where the judgment is uppermost and the judgment almost suffocates the narrative. So you, we're all familiar with history books like that. They're written from a very, very partisan, polemical perspective and they're more exercises in kind of political morality than they are in history. I think allowing your subject to breathe, you know, and your narrative and your judgment to be maybe provisional or to be not all encompassing, I think that's really important. As regards your yardstick question, I mean, I think ultimately all historians do apply a kind of yardstick of one kind or another, but it's their own kind of individual. It's again the yardstick of your own individual judgment. You know, if I'm writing a history book, and I'll be like, well, this is obviously an improvement. This is a sign of things getting worse. I think that's completely fine as long as you're complete upfront about what your standards about these are your individual standards, and you don't treat these as kind of absolute. In other words, you don't say there are standards that kind of float free of human agency. I think, you know, when I bring my own standards to bear in the past, they're very much my own prejudices and kind of predilections, and they're a product of my background and all of that kind of thing. And I think that's completely fine. There's no other way of doing it. There's no magic objective standpoint from, you know, there's no place where I could stand where I wouldn't be tainted by one kind of subjectivity or another. But I think that's okay.
Yeah. View from nowhere sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Nice. So at the beginning of this podcast, we asked you what maybe future generations would judge us for now. Well, if we could maybe have a brief history of the 21st century and give it to the British people in the 18th century, the 17th century, what do you think they would judge us most for?
Oh, wow. What would they judge us most for? That's a really good question. Yeah. What would they be most surprised by or impressed by?
What would kind of grip them? You mentioned the kind of pornography, so that's kind of what sparked the question.
Right. I mean, I suppose the thing that I always think would surprise people probably is the collapse in the division, in the gender division. I always think that's the thing that would have struck that our predecessors as kind of unthinkable or unimaginable, the idea that women and men would have equality, and that women would run the country or whatever, or run businesses, and that there will be no division of, you know, the division of labor between the domestic and the sort of the public and whatnot. I think that, you know, there were always people who pushed against that, of course, but they were small numbers. And I think they would be really surprised at that. I think clearly they would be, your examples, the 17th and 18th century, very God-fearing age. I think they'd be very shocked by the collapse of religious observance, the way in which Christianity no longer really plays any meaningful role in our kind of public life, I think would really surprise them. If you said to people, you can travel so quickly, you can access all culture, you're the click of a button, you can do, I mean, that they would obviously find all that absolutely extraordinary. So they'd be dazzled by all those kinds of things. But I think in terms of our gender politics, our kind of sexual politics and so on, our lack of a religious, overt religious sensibility, I think they would find those things very shocking. And I have to suspect they'd be very disappointed by the standard of our politics. They would be very downcast when they cast an eye over the people who'd run the country in the last 10 years or whatever. That would be very amusing to see, confront Sir Robert Walpole with his successors and ask him what he makes of them. But I think it'd be absolutely crushing for Robert Walpole. He'd probably have a stroke.
Well, Dominic, thank you very much. This is a last point to leave our listeners with, something maybe they can take and do their own research, perhaps. What's a historical event that isn't talked about enough?
Jeez. I mean, you sprang that on me. That's harsh.
End on a zinger.
Sorry, a bit extreme, but...
yeah. So obviously the Siege of Malta. Obviously the Siege of Malta is massive. What is that, 1565? Did you say it?
Had a big impact on European history, is what I hear.
Single most important event in European history, no? Isn't that what you're saying, Lucas? So I'd say the Siege of Malta, obviously. What else? What do I think listeners should all
something to know? Go away, maybe research for all.
Research. I want to research it.
Well, they can kind of go in and do their own research. Something that isn't really in the current conscious. It may have been in the past, but maybe it's
okay. So I'll tell you the period that basically nobody ever talks about. Which somebody said this to me in the 1990s, and basically my master's supervisor actually said it to me in the 1990s. And he was right then. It's still true now. Nobody cares about the 18th century. I mean, it's basically like it didn't happen. And it's weird. It's really weird because that is Britain's best century. So that's the century in which Britain was created, you know, the Act of Union. And it goes from being a not exactly a backwater, but kind of slightly on the fringe of Europe, second-rate power, to being top nation, basically at the end when we've won the Napoleonic Wars. You know, the Industrial Revolution, the creation of a kind of urbane, genteel, civilized society. Sort of, you've got, I don't know, coffee houses, newspapers, cartoons, politics, all of these kinds of things. The novel, amazing stuff, but nobody, it has no traction in the popular imagination. You know, if we were to sort of rattle off some of the prime ministers from the mid 18th century, nobody's, I mean, even the people who write about the period have never heard of them. So I think that to me is just, it's just a weird black hole in our national consciousness that this, the century where Britain became Britain and won the First World War, the Seven Years' War against the French, and then ended up smiting the French in the Napoleonic Wars at the end of it. And we don't know anything about it at all. And I think that's, it's weird. I don't really know why that is. I think maybe an excess of Whigs, but who knows?
Maybe also focus on the revolutions at the end of the century.
Of course. Yeah, it gets drowned out by
American, French, because that's seen as the break with the standard, right? So you just view what comes before as status quo implicitly, I guess, to some extent.
I think so. When it, yeah, it's an age of tremendous hurly-burly and change and excitement. So to think of it as sort of boring, you know, sort of Jane Austen, people sipping tea and making nervous small talk. I mean, that's obviously not what it's like at all. It's like mad riots and, you know, people faffing around with steam engines or whatever. I mean, that's very exciting if you like those kinds of things. I mean, I don't actually like steam engines, but I think it probably was very exciting. And everybody should, all your listeners should go and, what did you say? Go and research it. I think I should go and research it now. Yeah.
Well, Dominic, thank you for sipping tea with us, making nervous small talk instead of throwing a riot.
It was nervous, but you know, what can you do?
Yeah. Yeah. We really enjoyed ourselves. We hope you did too. We encourage all our listeners to go check out
definitely
the Rest is History podcast. This has been Critical Edge, signing off.